Now, what?
This is Mame Warren. Today is the 19th of July, 1999. I'm in Baltimore, and I'm still with Louise Cavanero. Let's talk about what you were just saying.
Yeah. If you're going to do a history, a 125-year history, to me, and I'm only speaking for the medical institutions, what you're going to have to do is look at the major changes that have occurred in the delivery of health care, what has happened in research that affects health care, and what are some of the major contributions made by the medical institutions to that whole scope? And then you're going to have to look at the major changes in providing education to the people who are delivering health care, the changes that have occurred in medical education and are still occurring right now, changes are being made. The changes in nursing education, nursing education, not just at Hopkins, but throughout the country is different from what it was. And the changes that are in the School of Public Health, the different specialties that people never heard of years ago, and they're all brought about by the changes in not just the delivery of health care, but in what's happened to life itself, that people are living longer, that we have automobiles and airplanes and things that are causing all kinds of accidents and problems in health care. These things, to me, unless you look at all these changes that have occurred, then you're kind of lost in what's going on in health care. In just my lifetime, I think, you know, I've been having some arthritis, and I think of my dad and my mother putting a mustard plaster on his back when he used to have back pain. Now, whether he had arthritis or whether he had a slipped disc, when I went in the military, I remember when we had soldiers come in and were complaining of these backaches and everything. First, everybody thought they were goof-offs, that they were trying to get out of doing military. That wasn't true. What they had were slipped discs, and back when the war started, we didn't know that much about them. And in fact, Dr. Dandy at Hopkins had a lot to do with the, Dr. Dandy, by the way, is dead, his son's still alive. But Dr. Dandy and some of the things that he developed when he was at Hopkins made it possible to diagnose some of these back problems, which we know today are true back problems. And in fact, we're finding out some of it during the war years, but I remember how often it was easy to just say, oh, well, they're just trying to get out of doing something. So that all these changes have occurred. And when I came to Hopkins, Dr. Morgan had arrived in radiology, and there was x-ray equipment all scattered all around the hospital. And one thing he did was he pointed out the dangers from scatter radiation. In fact, he was a big consultant to the federal government. And there were a number of radiologists who suffered as a result of exposure to radiation. Now you go to the dentist and they put a lead apron on you just to x-ray your teeth, which is what's right. But people weren't that careful back then. And so there were a lot of injuries that we saw that were due to misuse of different things. There weren't that many medicines to take. When I think of my dad, again, with his cardiac condition, I'm sure his life would have been a lot more pleasant if he had had his problem today than having it in the 1930s. So when you're looking at the 125-year history of Hopkins, you've got to think of those things. And there were people that came up with things back then that were the really basic foundation to some of the things that we're still doing today.
Who are those people? Who were the top people who come to your mind?
That come to my mind? Well, and some of the newer ones, for example, I think of like Perrin Long and some of these people that worked with sulfa drugs and the original doctors at Hopkins that work with malaria. And how you go through and pick out to do a 125-year history, you know, the really key people that change things, I think is going to be very difficult. And I would think, what I think the only way I would do it is probably sit down and using different reference books and things, that picking out names, looking at some things in the archives that might show you what different people contributed, and when you're making a list of all these, and then seeing now which ones had the most, biggest influence on the way care was delivered. And sometimes you may come up with people whose names aren't as big as Dr. Blaylock's, but some of their work, it certainly influenced the delivery of health care. I've never thought about it until we're just talking about it now. But there are those people, and that they were there. And as I said, a person doesn't become great or have a big discovery unless he has good support, whether it's fellows that are working in the lab, the technicians that work for him, whether it's nurses, whoever it is. People who have a great accomplishments, had good support from the people that work with them. And I think that's one thing that Hopkins has done extremely well. When I think back of two of the young women residents, when I one of my last jobs, the house staff came under me administratively for the hospital, and I worked, and I was the secretary of the house staff policy committee, it was called in those days. There were two women residents that I got to know quite well. Both of them have done extremely well. Susan McDonald is over at the Bayview campus. She's at the Allergy and Immunology Institute, and I know that Dr. Benz has given her some committee responsibility to, I think, as far as ways that how women can achieve more in medicine. The other one, and right now again I've got a lapse of her name, but it's terrible that I can't think of it right this minute. But she was in genetics, and these were really unusual women, and there have been a number of those women at Hopkins, and it would be very important in the history to point out those women. And going back to Sabin, who was the first one to become famous, but there have been a number since, and I think Hopkins should be proud of the fact that it has contributed. Some women did come to Hopkins and contributed a great deal. That's just a tremendous task to think about. And over in the school of, when I came in the School of Public Health, we still were grazing sheep on the Monument Street side of the building because we had to get sheep cells in order to do the serology tests for syphilis. Yeah, the sheep were bled, and that was 1953. There are pictures showing the first building of the School of Public Health didn't go all the way to Monument Street, and there was some grass and everything there, and the sheep grazed, and people would go over and draw fresh sheep cells in order to provide the material necessary to do serological tests for syphilis. Now they have completely different procedures for doing those studies. I mean, you don't have to have sheep cells anymore, you know. But you can see the changes that have occurred, you know.
What other secrets like that do you know?
Yeah,
that
about
I
the
don't
sheep.
Know? Yes,
I know. Well, you
what
know, you have
tip.
To. I know. You just you think back, and the old doctor's dining room, for example, which got torn down when they built the. The doctor's dining room would have gone when they built the children's center, because that area all got pulled in there, and it. I'll tell you, never saw a doctor come in there that was not, if he came down, he would have a white coat on, or in his clothes. The doctors, the chiefs of service, there was everybody was very properly dressed. I used to, the administrative staff ate in the old doctor's dining room, and when they built the new dining room, the new cafeteria, originally they had thought not to have a doctor's dining room, it's set up a different class of people, you know, and that it would be better not to have one. Well, it ended up there is a doctor's dining room, and different people eat in different places. I always, when the new cafeteria opened, there were some of us that felt that it was important to eat with the employees, and I did until the day I retired. Unless I was at a special luncheon sometime, which you had to go to. But I think that the old doctor's dining room had some sort of character to it that is kind of hard to signify. And it was, I'll never forget sitting in there one day I felt a hand on my shoulder, and I looked up, and it was one of the doctors with whom I had worked in Japan, a geneticist, and he was at Hopkins to see Dr. McCusick and somebody else, I forget. Anyway, he said, I asked him, he said, if by any chance, he said that I had a friend here, and I was wondering how I could locate her. And they said, what's her name? And he said, Louise Cavanero. They said, Cavi's sitting right over there. And this Hopkins becomes a small world. Through the years, I have had friends coming to Hopkins, people I knew before, and come to Hopkins. And some of them knew I was there, so that was one thing. Others didn't, but, you know, found out I was there. And so it's a place where, and it's a place where you meet all kinds of people. When I took over the Marburg building, we were short on funds in those days to make improvements, and nothing had been done during the war years because there just wasn't anything available. That wasn't not just the money, but the people to do the work either, you know. And in fact, there were still wooden floors in patient rooms on the first floor of Marburg. Wooden floors, which is unusual, you know. And there were some wooden benches in the corridors, and they were miserable to sit on. No padding, no nothing, and the seat was not comfortable even to sit on. And I'll never forget a patient that we had, the Hitts. Mr. Hitt was our patient, and his wife would sit outside the door of his room while he was asleep or when the doctor was with him. And she was talking to me one day about the miserable, and I said, oh, Ms. Hitt, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And if I had the money, believe me, I would replace them. Well, now, how much do you need? And I looked at her, and she said, well, you find out. How much do you need to do not just this floor, but the whole building with better, you know, replace all these benches? So I got the money, and she gave it to me, and I got new that's how I got the first couches. That's how I got the money to buy an EKG machine. Now, of course, everything's done electronically into central place, but the doctors wanted an EKG machine in case for an emergency on them. One of the patients gave me the money for that. Another patient fixed up two porches for patients' families could sit and wait. You know, they would come to me crying about something, and I'd tell them, And, you know, I say, well, I'm, you know, I agree with you, but I just don't have the money to do it. And they would give me the money to do it. Don't operate that way anymore. But,
well... What do you mean? Why not? What's changed?
Well, I think that there's... now there's such a large staff, development staff, you know, and doing it. Although, the way you treat people, Clyde Bear, for example, I got to know them through his father, and the help that I gave that family resulted in not just $50,000 to the Cavanero Scholarship Fund, but I know he gave $250,000 to the Tumulty Fund to support the Tumulty Professorship. They didn't even know about him, and I suggested that they contact him, and he was, because he was very grateful for the care that Dr. Tumulty had given to his father and to his wife. I think you have contacts, and people like me and working would have contacts that certainly you could, you know, recommend to development officers to follow up on, things like that. But it's the way people are treated is important. And patients are very much aware, you know, of whether or not people are interested in them or not as a person. And that's the one thing that I started, what we call the patient representatives program, where we had assigned personnel to each of the services, and they would work with patients on complaints so that the patients didn't feel like they had to complain to the nurse or the doctor, and then that it would get taken out on them afterward, you know. And, you know, we make mistakes, and I point out to patients that, you know, there are thousands of people working here, and I haven't noticed any wings and halos on anybody, which, you know, is true. I think that, and usually, you know, and the one thing Dr. Nelson told me a long time ago, and he says, you know, when somebody starts complaining, listen. Listen, and don't necessarily respond, you know, and then so often... the complaint is really what it is their own, they're concerned. I'll never forget, I went to one patient on Marburg that was complaining bitterly, and I went over to talk to her, and her husband was there, and so I let her go on and expound about everything that was wrong and so on, and then I pointed out a few things after she was all finished, and I said, well, I'm still glad, you know, that she wanted to bring these things to our attention. But then I pointed out a couple of things to her. And then she looked at me and she said, you know, you've been listening to me, she said, for 30 minutes. And she said, you know what you made me realize? We're trying to blame my illness on somebody else, which was what it was. She had wanted them to do some things that were not good medically, and the Hopkins doctors had refused to do that. They didn't do the best job of explaining to her probably why they would not recommend what she wanted. And she had been to some other hospitals where some things had been done that should not have been done. But you have to be careful when you say that to somebody too. And I think that listening to people's complaints is an important part of any administrator's job.
A while ago, you were talking about how certain doctors rise within the administration. How does a doctor who spends all these years getting all this medical training, how do they know how to be an administrator? Are they trained?
Well,
for
nowadays
that too?
They're training them now. This in recent years, they now have a program over there. They bring people in to give special classes and different things. Well, I'll tell you what I did a long time ago. Dr. Nelson assigned. We had patient committees, for care committees. The Osler Patient Care Committee was medicine, Department of Medicine. And the administrator at that time was I. And when I'll never forget the first meeting, the first two meetings I went to, and boy, they were complaining about this, complaining about that, and I really felt beaten down like mad, you know. And part of it stemmed from the fact that they didn't understand how healthcare was financed. They had no understanding of it at all. So I suggested to, Dr. Ross was then chairman of the committee, he later became dean, and I said, Dr. Ross, why don't I arrange to bring the treasurer of the hospital to the next meeting and let him review with all of you what payments we're getting for what care and so on, which we did. And that was the beginning of a number of different educational opportunities. And I think the more the, as administrators, that as we were assigned to departments, well, they, Dr. Nelson desegregated the administrative staff instead of having them all centrally. Like for a while, for example, I was mainly surgical. I had the psychiatric unit for five years on a temporary basis, temporary for 5 years. Then for a while, I had both Halsted and Osler. I had both medicine and surgery. And that just became too much for me. And so what they did was appoint somebody to take medicine. Then I went 50% with the university and 50% with the hospital. I took everything administrative for the university in the Department of Surgery and everything administrative for the hospital in the department. And I did that from 64 to 72 when I went back just full-time with the hospital. But I think that there are some people that have good skills, administrative skills, and some people don't. And no matter how much you send them to school, you aren't going to make them good administrators. On the other hand, there are some people, because some, for one thing, they don't always delegate well. Learning to delegate, you know, is an important thing. And if you're going to, if nobody can make a decision but you in a big department, you got problems. And how do you delegate and what do you delegate? And how do you bring people together? The Department of Surgery, we met every Saturday morning. We had a Department of Surgery staff meeting, which was the heads of all the departments in surgery, otolaryngology, neurosurgery, orthopedic surgery, plastic surgery, pediatric surgery, all this, and along with the chairman of the department. And I was the secretary of that. So that, and at that gave me the opportunity when I see that something was lacking in the way of information that they needed, you know, to get that out or to bring somebody in and discuss it that would be a better person than I, you know. And I think that's what you do. There, I think that there are good administrators and there's some that are not good. But being able to delegate is one of the, being important to me, one of the most important things.
Yeah, teach me how to do that. Mm-hmm. That's always been one of my hard parts. Mm. A long time ago, back at the beginning, you made mention of strikes.
Yeah, we had several, there have been several strikes. The first one was in the 60s, and it came after the Martin Luther King death thing, and the employees were out for quite a while. Those are all recorded in the archives.
But tell me what it was like to be an administrator during that time.
Well, we had volunteers that came in to help. We had doctors serving food up in the cafeteria and volunteered to come in and do things like that. We had a lot of volunteers, and those and what the hospital did was everybody who had a job in the hospital that could stop for the time being, you know, went to work doing other things in the hospital, like served, some of them served as ward clerks. I have pictures of me picking up garbage. I stayed on to do certain, I was an administrator doing certain things, but we all did other things to help, to pitch in. We managed. The strike, the first strike was a long one.
That must have been quite a time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Baltimore had riots, too.
Oh, yes, right? But not as bad as Washington.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of difficult times, going back to integration, Was there any resistance within the administration to integrating the hospital?
Not within the administration. I think there were some members of the medical staff that probably weren't too keen about it, some of the old-timers that, but even those, there were people, I remember reading, it was documented, I read something in the archives, where a patient had been referred in to the Department of Medicine, and Dr. Harvey was the new chairman of the department at that time. It was back in the 40s. And the doctor, I can't remember the doctor that was to treat the patient. I think I may have noted it, though, in my paper on desegregation, that when the patient arrived, he was black. It was unknown that he was going to have a black patient to this doctor. And he didn't know whether he could admit him or not. Anyway, he contacted Dr. Harvey, and Dr. Harvey said to treat him like any other patient. There were, I think that, we had some patients who resented having black patients near them. A few doctors that I know were against integration. Basically, it went very smoothly. But one thing we didn't do was to send out memos about integrating. We just did it. If you don't put it in writing, how can anybody gripe or complain?
How about the medical staff? When did black nurses come in? When did black doctors come in?
Oh, well, we had black nurses. The black doctors, Mac Harvey gave the first appointment to a black doctor, Ralph Young. The black doctors sort of, see, the Department of Surgery had its first black intern back in the 60s. With the schools not being desegregated, it made it very difficult to, with the medical school. Mm-hmm. Now there are, of course, the medical school, they're running around 10% plus or minus 11% are black medical students. And with that, oh, and then they said Levi Watkins he's black. He is one of the associate deans, and he did a lot of recruiting to get good blacks into the medical school.
Tell me about him.
Well, he's from Montgomery, Alabama. They were great friends of, his father was the president of Alabama State University, and which is a black school in Montgomery. And they were friends of Martin Luther King's. Levi's very light. His mother and father were both very light. I've met both of them. I think they're both dead now. I know his father died, and I think his mother died too since. I'm not sure, but as far as I know, Levi hasn't married. He's very light-skinned. He was the first black medical student at Vanderbilt. He was not the first black intern in surgery at Hopkins, but he was the first black to go through the entire surgical training program. And I was still with surgery when he came up to be interviewed. So I've known him actually since then. And when his father was, he brought his father up as our patient, and I met his parents at that time. He's interesting, you know. He's had a different education than the average black has that we see here in Baltimore, you know, that. Now, here's Ben Carson, an outstanding neurosurgeon, world famous, from the inner city of Detroit. soft-spoken, very well-spoken. His mother did a good job on him, I'll tell you. So, when, you know, just because you lived in the inner city in a ghetto doesn't mean you can't become something. Because Ben sure did. Ben Carson did. I think in talking, you're certainly going to have to cover the relationship of blacks and within the institution in any history. So, I mean, I think it would be worthwhile talking to both Levi and Ben Carson.
They're both on my list.
Yeah. The there's a well, of course, there's some excellent blacks in the School of Nursing, by the way, on the faculty now. And one of the professors in the School of Nursing is the first black female to get a professorship in the university.
I know she.
Now that you see,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can give you these names at work, though. I have them right there. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But I think that, and she has a son who's, I think he's a medical student at Maryland. I'm not sure. Yeah. She's an interesting gal. She went to school. She did some of her graduate work in Sweden. She's the one that's in charge of the international programs we have in nursing and exchange of nurses and whatnot. Yeah, she's interesting.
When you look back on your career,
uh-huh,
are there any missed opportunities, things that you look back and say, oh, I wish I'd gotten to do that, or I wish Hopkins had done that?
When I look back on my life, I can see some things that maybe I should have done differently. On the other hand, if I'd done them differently, I wouldn't be here today. I made the most of my life, I feel, in many ways. When I left Japan, you know, I told the National Academy, give me $600 and I'll pay my own way home instead of you sending me home on the President Cleveland first class, you know. So I went around the world. I went to, and I spent 7 weeks on a Swedish freighter, and then when we took the train from Basra to Baghdad, and the desert bus from Baghdad to Damascus, and rented a car to Lebanon, and flew to over to Egypt, took the train down the Nile, and, you know, it was a great trip. And it was an enriching experience to see. I read the book, The Age of Faith, where he reviews the world's great religions, you know. And I think before you go to some of these countries, you should know about Buddhism before you go to India and Sri Lanka. Now it was Ceylon when I went. In the Hindu religion and the Muslim religion, and all those were in the book The Age of Faith. I'm glad I did it. In fact, some of the experiences in World War II really changed my life. I saw so many young people. I'll never forget one who had lost his arm saying to me, I'm never going to get to play tennis the way I wanted to play tennis. And he said, I kept putting off doing this and putting off doing that. Now what am I going to do? And I decided that, you know, never, never live. And he said, why didn't I do that? You have to make decisions, whether they're right or wrong. But at least you make them. And I made a decision not to stay in the regular army. I was offered a commission in the regular army, and I went with the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission. I elected to go into hospital administration, and I elected to do it at Columbia. And that's how I came to Hopkins, basically. And I had wonderful jobs at Hopkins. I worked with really great people, and I learned a lot from them. And I've had a very rewarding life, I think. I feel very fortunate.
I think Hopkins is very fortunate.
Well, no, but you know, as I said at my retirement, when they gave me the award for the Cavanero Scholarship Fund, I said, not everybody gets to read their own epitaph, you know. That's, and the fund is over $160,000 now, so isn't that great?
Oh, what an honor.
Yeah.
What an honor.
And they've made me an honorary member of the Hopkins Nurses Alumni Association. This year they did. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know how you decide whether you would do something different. I really don't.
Do you think that when you think of Johns Hopkins,
mm-hmm.
do you think you can say it has a personality that can be described?
Oh, yes. I think it would probably be very, I'd have to think about how to describe that. It has a personality, yes. How best to describe it? As I pointed out to you, it's great, not just because of some real brilliant people at the top, but what supported them. And at the centennial, when they made me the chairman of the employee committee, although I was retired, when I talked to Dr. Heisel about my budget for the hospital employees, I said, you know, the employees always feel that these functions are for the brass, you know? And I think it's important for the 100th that we do something so that they know that they've made a contribution and are very much a part of this 100-year celebration. And so he got me what I asked for.
They
got me the money. I had to find out who I could bring in as a top entertainer. I brought in Gladys Knight. Yeah. Uh-huh. Downtown at the where they used to play the basketball games. I forget what they call it now. They change the name of that place all the time. Anyway, we had, I arranged it so that all the shifts could make it. I had earlier in the evening so that the people who had worked days could come and the people who were going on night could come. Then I had one at 11:30 so that the people who were working the evening shift could come to that one. And then one night we had a baseball game and they had to buy their tickets, but they gave them their tickets for what the special cost that we got, which was less, several dollars less than you if you'd bought your own ticket to the ball game. And then if they wanted to come and have a feed in the outfield with the team, I got a special price for the food that I would have out there served for them. And they had to pay for that, but it was a lot less. And as it turned out, there was a terrible storm the night of the ball game, so that we had to cancel the cookout. But the ball game went on, so that was great. So the next day, I got word out to everybody that contributed. There's about $6,000 that had come in that they could get their refunds and where to go to get them because of the missed dinner. That any money that was left, we were going to give to the high school right near us, there, right near Hopkins, Dunbar High School, and to be used for scholarship money for students for college. And do you know, not one person came and asked for their money back. I thought that was great. That shows you something about the spirit of the people. They really are. And I think that there are people like, Dr. Heisel had a couple of fairs. We had them on the parking lot. And one of the doctors, Dr. Shirash, Sam Sharash, who's done a lot of work with sickle cell anemia. Sam came out and worked that first day. Dr. Heisel put me in charge of the fair, and he came out and manned a booth for me, and we had sickle cell anemia on the balloons. And then he had asked me to get from NIH their brochure. Well, it wasn't as good, so he redid the brochure so that the people could really understand about sickle cell anemia. You know, that's a disease of black people. I don't know if you know about it or not.
Tell me.
Well, I can't tell you a lot about it, except it's a hemolytic disease mm-hmm. that's inherited. And there's a gene, apparently, and it gets inherited.
So anyways, this was a fair for the local neighborhood.
Everybody to come. We had food, and we had all sorts of things going, and different booths, and Sam did it for me on sickle cell anemia, and we had these handouts to give to the people that came to learn about it, and it was right out on the grounds there, you know. Mm-hmm. It was really very interesting, very successful. And Dr. Sharash out there filling those balloons, I'm telling you. Well,
we've talked about a lot of things. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to include?
I think it's I was just looking over at something that some of my friends gave me when I retired.
Hold on. It's okay.
Okay.
I'm going to put it on pause.
Read this to me. The Lunch Bunch was a group that used to eat in the dining room, and there were 10 of us to start with. Two of them have passed away, and two of them have moved away. So we're down to 6, actually, right now, but we still get together to celebrate each other's birthdays. But in the old days, when two people are still working at the hospital. And so when I retired, one of the men who's dead now did a lot of work with wood, and this piece of wood he got out, and they decided to give me this that Cavi from the Lunch Bunch, tacked the art of telling someone to go to hell in such a manner that he anticipates the trip. And they said that personified me. I don't know. I guess I tried to be, one of the things that I tried to be was honest, and I think honesty is the most important thing. You can't always tell people that they can have what they want, but when you tell them why something can't be done, you ought to tell them why it can't be done and not just say no. The word no is a bad word alone, but I found that the physicians understood when they used to be on my back in the Phipps building for air conditioning, when we didn't even have enough power into the building to practically turn the lights on, let alone bring in air conditioning. And until we got a new substation over there, we were unable to bring air conditioning into the building. But if people understand, it's easier to accept. Not always happy about it, but at least, you know, once people think you're dishonest and that you lie about something, why, you have a, I don't know, to me. So if that's what they told me, that I can tell them to go to hell without anticipating. But I think the Lunch Bunch, I think, shows you something about Hopkins. Lottie Cole, who is one of the members of that group, it was a black gal who came to Hopkins as a clerk in the medical records department and went on to finish college and everything and became the director of medical records at one time. And Lottie's part of this Lunch Bunch. And I think that a number of people back in the old, after World War II, a couple men came in that were members of this Lunch Bunch. One of them was the administrator in the emergency department eventually. But they came in from the war and went into jobs and worked themselves up. The other was an assistant administrator in laboratory medicine. He's still alive. But the one that was in the emergency department had a great sense of humor. And well, I think you have to have a sense of humor to survive certain things in life anyway.
I have to turn the tape over because I just realized an amazing thing I haven't asked you.
You know, you're describing your lunch bunch to me.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, this was a mixed group, male and female,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
an integrated group, mm-hmm. racially integrated. Mm-hmm. I'm ignoring the elephant, you know, the elephant that's in the room and you just don't talk about it. I've ignored this elephant in this room. You're a woman.
Oh,
in 1953.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Becoming an administrator at Johns Hopkins.
Oh, yeah.
My God, we haven't talked about that.
The third woman on the administrative staff. There was a fourth woman. I could be called the fourth or the third, depending upon what you call the one. But she was an administrative assistant in her when she was doing her residency in hospital administration. She had gone to school in the School of Public Health, and she became the director of medical records. So basically, I was the third woman to have a responsible administrative position at the hospital. Yeah. The first one was during World War I when some of the men were called off to war. And the next one was a gal named Eileen Foley who came after the war. She'd been in the waves during the war. And Eileen is, of course, retired. She is still alive and up in Pennsylvania, in fact. We get together every once in a while.
But tell me, was there ever a sense? I mean, you were a pioneer.
I know.
You weren't the first, but you were a pioneer.
One thing I can say this, when I hear women going on about all this business, somebody pinching them and all that sort of stuff, I was never bothered at Hopkins by anybody. And of course, this crowd will tell you nobody would dare. But I think the way you're treated depends upon the way you act. And I think it's as true today as it was when I came. I think that I never felt, and you can ask the John Camerons and the Dick Ross and people like that, I never felt that because I was a female that there was a lack of cooperation administratively. I never felt that. If there were, but you'll get the best response from them on that. I think that the things that I was fortunate that, for example, I was the administrator when we first started dialysis in order to do transplantation. I have been involved in transplantation since 1967 when that all started until November of 1998 when I went off the board of the Transplant Resource Center of Maryland. I have been involved in transplantation all those years without, even after I'm retired. I was on the Governor's Commission on Kidney Disease for two terms. I served 8 years on that. That's all you can do on any governor's commission. I was with the original Southeastern Oregon Procurement Foundation that established sharing of kidneys before UNOS, that you read about in the papers today, came into being. In fact, UNOS took over our computer program on the sharing. And I worked with the schools that were involved were the University of Maryland, Hopkins, Medical College of Virginia, University of Virginia, Vanderbilt, Emory, Duke, University of North Carolina. I guess that was it. There were eight of us. And we shared kidneys back and forth between each other. The first time we had to ship one out, nobody had money. How were we going to get a ticket? I used my credit card to get the airplane ticket to get the kidney to where it was going. And the nurse that was in, she's a nurse, but she wasn't acting as a nurse in this regard. And Kathy Hopkins will tell you, well, you know, Cav gave us her credit card, and that's how we got the kidney moving. So these are wonderful experiences that not everybody has a chance to do. You know, to be the administrator when new things were starting, and to, you know, not to say, well, we don't have that, but all right, what do we do? You made, you just did it, you know, that was it. the first time we ran a patient on dialysis, the nurses didn't have anything to do with it. The director, the then director of nursing, said that isn't a nursing. So I stayed with, after all, I was a nurse. So I stayed with the doctors. We dialyzed the patient, and when we were finished and saved her, she had overdosed on something. The young doctors all started to leave, and Dr. Walker, I'll never forget him, said, "Nobody's leaving. You're all staying to help Cavi clean up." And that was it. They all stayed and helped me clean up the mess. But you know, these are opportunities that don't come to everybody. So I think that I owe a lot of the happiness of my life, I'm sure, to the people with whom I worked at Hopkins. And whether it's Mel Williams, the transplant, when he started doing the transplants, and he's still there, and Gordon Walker's still around, and those. And then we organized locally, and then when things, you know, when there was a national program. See, in the beginning, Medicare didn't pay for any of that. Now Medicare has taken over. And so after I retired, I was recommended for the Transplant Resource Center Board by Dr. McLaughlin at the University of Maryland. I had worked with him, and, you know, he said that I could be brought on not representing Hopkins, because I was not Hopkins anymore, but representing the public. And I was on representing the public for all that period of time. And what did they give me when I retired in November? They gave me a big Bertha golf club. But they said, now, if you don't want it, you can turn it back in. Jay Perkins will let you have credit toward what you want. So I did. I took it back, and I didn't want the big Bertha, but I added a few hundred dollars to the... A big Bertha is $210. I added some money to it and got new irons, which I wanted.
All right.
So that was all right. But, you know, these are things that occur in your life that I feel very fortunate, you know. And when I, on the board of CEOP, all the years I was on, my next to last year, at a meeting at the Kennedy Center in Washington, they gave me the Upjohn Award for my contribution to the organization, which I'll show it to you before you, and things like that that make your life pleasant, you know. And as you can see, I've been a collector. I'm very interested in art that I like, you know. It's not whether it's valuable or not, it's whether it, what it means to me. I did give a wall hanging I used to have over there, I gave to the Walters Art Gallery 2 years ago. They wanted it if I ever didn't want to. And it means more to them. For us, it's a Buddha on a lotus leaf. It was done in 1787. Very nice piece, God. Yeah.
Well, I feel like we could go on forever, but I also feel like you need to have your life back. Yeah. So I'm going to unhook you now.
Okay.
And we'll go over some names and talk about a few other things.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.